Well, welcome back to part two of our Elimination of Bias Diversity and Inclusion program. Once again, we're coming live here in May 2022, but most of you will be taking the program as an on-demand program. And as we mentioned in the first part of the program, we'll continue giving a series of code numbers during the course of the program. Write those down and send them to me at the conclusion of the program so that we can record your attendance. And again, the address to send those to is clem.law@usa.net. That's clem.law@usa.net. And we'll get you your certificate of attendance and get your elimination of bias or diversity and inclusion credit all taken care of. If you need more information about this program or find out about my other programs, please visit my website, richardclem.com, where you'll find more information. We're picking up in the course materials. Again, if you want to be following along, you can, or you just want to consult them later on as a refresher of what we've talked about. But we're on page 4 of the course materials, and we see a couple of categories that came up at some of these listening sessions talking about employing people of color, and the next one, appoint more minority judges and court staff. So in other words, questions about the makeup of not only the judiciary, but also the people working in the court in the courthouse, and I think also we can include in that group ourselves as attorneys. What is the makeup of the people working in our judicial system in the state of Minnesota or in the state of Iowa? Now, this when we get to this topic, I always have to disclose I consider myself a card carrying conservative, and when I see categories like this, employ more people of color, or appoint more minority judges, my initial reaction when I see these is, well, wait a minute, that should not be a factor in determining how we staff our courthouse and what the makeup of the bar in this state. That's not a proper consideration. We want the best person for the job, and to a certain extent, I guess I still adhere to that. But my thinking on this was changed a little bit. And again, like I say, I have learned more by giving these programs than I've instilled knowledge, I think. And one of the things I learned when giving this program was a very, very good discussion I had with an African American attorney who was taking the program, and he invited me to conduct kind of a little thought experiment and see why maybe this is kind of an important issue. So for example, for this thought experiment, I happen to reside in Ramsey County, Minnesota. I live in Ramsey County, Minnesota, which is where St. Paul, Minnesota is located. And I don't know the exact makeup of the population of Ramsey County, but a significant portion of the population are people that look kind of like me. Our skin is approximately the same color. When I went to elementary school, we had a crayon in our crayon box called Flesh, my skin is the color of that crayon. I understand they changed the name of that crayon, I think to something like Peach. So uh, So my skin is kind of the color of a peach. They changed the color of that because they recognized that some people have flesh that's a different color. So that wasn't a good name for the folks that had Crayola to name their crayons. But anyway, my skin is this peach color, as is the skin of a lot of people in the county. And that's not that big of a deal. Which crayon happens to match my flesh tone, but that's one part of my identity. That's the color of my skin. As it is for a fairly large portion of the population. Well, other people have a different crayon associated with their skin, and also a lot of people in the county differ from me in very different ways. So, for example, we have a pretty substantial African American population in Ramsey County, and we have a pretty substantial Asian population in the county. We have a pretty substantial Native American population in the county. We have a fairly substantial population in the county of persons with disabilities. And I can just, I can go keep rattling that list on and on, because obviously everybody in the county is different. Not everybody in the county is exactly like me. We have a lot of different people. But a fairly significant percentage of them, I don't even know if it's a majority, but a fairly significant number of the people in the county are what we would commonly call white people, namely people with a skin that looks kind of like mine and with an ancestry that looks kind of like mine. So I don't know if it's a majority, but it's probably 50% or so. Probably a little bit more than that, maybe a little bit less than that, but there are a lot of white people in the county. Now, having set that up so elaborately, kind of speaking the obvious, I get in trouble. So we're going to do our thought experiment here. I get myself into a little bit of trouble, and I find myself being a criminal defendant, and I'm charged with some criminal offense. But of course I have full faith in the integrity of the judicial system in this county. I know it is staffed by prosecuting attorneys and defense attorneys and judges and court staff and everybody else who are their main concern is seeing to it that justice is done. So there's a little bit of trepidation in the fact that I find myself being a criminal defendant, but I have no doubt whatsoever that I will get a fair trial. And if I'm innocent, I have no doubt whatsoever that my innocence will be shown and I will be vindicated. So anyway, I get I show up in court because I have my court date, the judge walks in. I'm sitting there, and it's an African American judge. Well, or it's an Asian judge, but let's say it's an African American judge. Well, I probably wouldn't even notice that, because that's not something I'm attuned to, the color of different people's skin. I would just know that this judge was duly appointed or elected to serve as a judge of the 4th Judicial District, and I have no doubt whatsoever that I will get a fair trial. And like I say, the color of the judge's skin does not even enter my thought process whatsoever. But then I look around a little bit more, and I notice the prosecuting attorney, the person who's prosecuting me today, also happens to be an African-American person. Once again, I have no doubt that that person is, going to do the duty that he's constitutionally required to do and bring a case against me only if it's supported by probable cause, and he's going to treat me fairly. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. And once again, I wouldn't even notice that person's race. And then I look around a little bit more, and the court reporter also happens to be African American. Again, not a big deal. The bailiff is an African American. The jury comes in, and they are all African American. My defense attorney, I look at him, and he is African American. I go down to the clerk's office, and everybody in the court administrator's office is African American. At some point, I'm going to notice this. And at some point, even though I know to an absolute certainty that all these people who are working there are going to treat me fairly, I know that intellectually, but at some point in that hypothetical, I'm going to start having doubts about the fairness of the system. Because why is it when a fairly significant, maybe not a majority, but a fairly significant portion of my community happens to look a certain way, why is it that everybody else I encounter in the courtroom looks different from that? Again, something weird is going on here. Is there any actual bias as a result of that? Well, perhaps not, but at the very least, I think we're giving rise to a perception of bias. So that hypothetical, that seems outlandish. That's certainly not going to happen, because every time I've been at the courthouse, many of the people I see, not all of them, but many of them, there's very, what I would say, very good diversity in the court system in my county. So I don't see that. But some people do see that. So, for example, at one of the very first listening sessions we were talking about that was being held in Columbia Heights. So this was early on in the process when they started doing these listening sessions, like in 2010 or something like that. So these numbers have changed a little bit since then. But the very first comment they had was that, well, everybody up on the stage, everybody who came from the judicial branch to listen to the public, every single person who came representing the judicial branch was white. There was not any African American, there was not any Asian. It was just 100% white. So the people in that room who were not 100% Caucasian, they were facing that exact same hypothetical. In fact, people in the courtroom could be very well experiencing that same hypothetical. Because at that time, and I suspect this has changed, but at that time in the 10th Judicial District, there were 43 judges in the 10th District, which includes Anoka County and some of the other counties surrounding that. There were 43 judges in that district, and only one of them was of a minority race. So for most of the county courthouses, 100% of the judges were white. So that hypothetical that sounded very absurd to us, that's not quite so absurd for the African American defendant in Anoka County. That is their reality. The court staff, now there's probably some court staff, I'm sure, and I think things have probably changed in the 10 or so years since that happened. But it's a real issue, and that really does give rise to at least an appearance of bias within the system, even if there's no actual bias. Because, again, I've appeared before many of those 43 judges, and I cannot point to a single one of them and say, Judge so-and-so is biased against anybody. But it at the very least, it gives rise to that perception of bias, which is something we need to exclude. Well, how do we, okay, so now I have a little bit of cognitive dissonance here in myself, because, like I say, I'm a card-carrying conservative. And, this is affirmative action that we're talking about. And as a card-carrying conservative, of course, I'm opposed to affirmative action. And why am I opposed to affirmative action? Well, because we need to have the most qualified person for the job. So when we when the governor appoints a judge, or when I as a voter elect a judge, I want to vote for the person who is the most qualified person for the job. And the color of the person's skin should not be a consideration. Or should it? Because, well, perhaps because of that hypothetical that we talked about, perhaps the color of the person's skin maybe actually is one factor that should be considered. Is the diversity of the bench important enough that I, as the governor, when selecting somebody to serve as judge, or when I, as a voter, voting for somebody to serve in a position such as that, well, perhaps the person's contribution to the diversity of the bench, perhaps that is an important issue, because well, it's not fair to that prospective judge. Well, you don't go into a life of public service out of fairness to yourself. You do it to serve your community, in that case, if you are not, if you contribute to lack of diversity on the bench, well, perhaps you're not serving the community as you should. So in other words, that probably is one of the things that makes you the most the most qualified person for the job. And again, we remember at the beginning we mentioned Justice Rosalie Wall, who was behind this 1993 committee that looked into bias in the court system, and she had a lot of experience with it. Because she went in there and, well, you were appointed only because you were a woman. You are not the most qualified person for the job. She faced that criticism as well. Well, but on the other hand, the fact that she was a woman, I think, is one of the things that made her the most qualified person for the job. And there's an interesting corollary, another example. About this same time, a few years later, I believe, was when President Reagan appointed Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to the bench of the U.S. Supreme Court, the first woman to serve in that role. And President Reagan faced much of the same criticism that Governor Perpich faced in making that appointment. Namely, well, you didn't appoint her because she was the most qualified person for the job. You appointed her only because she was a woman. Well, my answer to that is, well, yeah, that I think in both of those cases it's probably true. They were appointed because they were a woman. But the fact that they were a woman, I think, made them the most qualified person for the job, because that diversity had been missing the whole time. And in both cases, even though they're very different politically, again, I would say Justice Wall of the Minnesota Supreme Court and Justice O'Connor of the U.S. Supreme Court, again, I would rank them as among some of the top jurists of the 20th century. So time proved that they were indeed the most qualified person for the job, partly because they brought that diversity there, but also because there was a reason why they had been historically underrepresented. Interestingly enough, both Justice Wall and Justice O'Connor have an account early in their career. They graduated from law school. They went out looking for a job. And in both cases, I believe they were offered a job as a legal secretary. Because they, law firms weren't hiring women to serve as attorneys, but they were hiring them to serve as legal secretaries. And if you, graduated with honors from law school, you're probably going to be a pretty good legal secretary. So they were both made that same offer, and unfortunately, both of them declined it, and kind of clawed their way into the legal profession. But the fact is, Justice O'Connor, at the time of her appointment, was an associate justice on the Arizona Court of Appeals. Justice Wall was an assistant public defender at a time when it would be normal to pick from a slightly higher strata of the legal profession. So in the case of the U.S. Supreme Court, you don't pick somebody who went to law school in California and who is in an Arizona Intermediate Appellate Court. You pick somebody who went to Harvard or Yale, who is serving as a justice in the, or a judge in the D.C. Circuit or something like that. So she did not have the traditional qualifications. For the state Supreme Court, it would probably be more common to name a sometimes a member of the legislature or a county attorney or a district judge. But again, the governor reached out a little bit deeper into the pool of available talent and picked an assistant public defender. Well, perhaps the reason why those judges had not risen higher in the legal profession probably was because of the fact that to a certain extent there was discrimination against them, either overt discrimination or just kind of this, we do have a job for you as a legal secretary. You're not going to rise as high. So probably if they had been male, they probably would have been in that higher strata, and there probably wouldn't have been as much question about whether they were the most qualified for the position. So again, am I saying we should just switch over and just have affirmative action be the only criteria we use when choosing judges and court staff or any kind of employment in the legal profession? No. But on the other hand, I guess I still cling to my view that when hiring for any position, you should see to it that you get the most qualified person for the job. But again, the makeup of the bench, I believe, is one of the things that makes you the most qualified person for the position. The slightly related to that is the question of makeup of juries. And here I think we've done a better job since 1993 in making sure that there's diversity on the panel of potential jurors that are presented. One issue that came up, though, in Pine County, and again, this goes back a ways, it was noted, how do we pick jurors in Minnesota? Well, they have a pretty good system to see to it that every eligible or most eligible residents of the state are picked for jury duty. And that is, first of all, the driver's license database. Most people have a driver's license. I have a driver's license. You probably have a driver's license. So you're in the database for that reason. But not everybody has a driver's license. We also look at the state identification card database. That's kind of the same database. So if you, for whatever reason, do not drive a car, you can get a Minnesota state identification card, and many people, or probably most people who don't have a driver's license, have that state identification card because sometimes you needed identification when, cashing a check at the bank or whatever. So most people have that. And then also the voter rolls. Historically, it's been registered voters who were selected for jury duty. But at some point a few decades ago, that driver's license database was melded into the system. So it does a pretty good job of catching everybody who is eligible for jury duty. And everybody who's in one of those databases has an equal chance of being potentially selected for jury duty, almost. Because the exception is, if for whatever reason I don't have a driver's license, I'm probably a registered voter. But there are, in Minnesota, especially because you can register at the polls, there have been times in my life when I was not a registered voter. Even though I voted in every election since I turned 18, with one exception, I forgot the city primary one year. I still feel bad about that. But even though I always vote, there have been times in my life when I have not been a registered voter. And because that is, I have never walked into an office and said, I want to register to vote. I have, every time I've registered to vote, I've done it at the polls. So when I turned 18, the next election was a few months away. Well, I wasn't a registered voter until election day. And then when I've moved at various times in my life, the day that I move, I cease to be a registered voter, and I do not become a registered voter again until the next election day. So therefore, there are some people who fall through the cracks, or maybe they just don't vote. But even civic-minded people like me, there are times when I am not a registered voter because I have moved. Maybe within the last year. A lot of people only vote every 2 years, so you might have moved 2 years ago. So there's a 2-year stretch of your life when you're not a registered voter, even though you think of yourself as a civic-minded citizen. Most of those people are picked up, though, by the driver's license database and or the Minnesota State ID database. One group, though, that it was pointed out might not be picked up, and for that reason there might be underrepresentation of Native Americans. Because if you are a Native American, depending on where you live, if you're a registered voter, that's great. But like I say, even though you're very civic-minded, you vote all the time, there might be this 2-year period when you're not a registered voter. Well, there's a better chance in your case that you do not have a Minnesota driver's license or state ID card because you might have a corresponding tribal ID. It was pointed out at this listening session in Pine County that there might be underrepresentation of Native Americans for that reason. So I don't know if that's still the case or not, but that is something that the legislature should keep in mind, because you do need that broad representation of people serving on juries. One of the more recent listening sessions in Rochester, they were kind of brainstorming from the audience, perhaps they want to dig even deeper, and they came up with some ideas of other databases that can be incorporated for jury duty, such as utility bills. If you're paying an electric bill, that means you're probably a resident of that county, even though you're not you don't have a driver's license or whatever. Of course, the utility bill only comes in the name of one resident of a property usually. But they actually came up with a pretty good brainstorming of ideas. The phone book, tax returns. So forth, just to make sure that as close as possible to 100% of the people have access or have the potential of being called for jury duty, to make sure that when somebody does assert the right to a jury trial, that it truly is a jury of their peers and everyone is represented in that potential pool. At this point, I'm going to give our next code number. Once again, during the program, I'll give a series of code numbers, write them down, and email them to me. The next code number for this portion of the program is B064. 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 B64 is the next code number. Court access. Do people have access to the court system? And here we're Yeah, well, of course, as a theoretical construct, everybody has access to the court system. But here they're talking a little bit more like about the physical access to the courthouse. And here, of course, is one physical change that's taken place was COVID, where the physical access to the courthouse actually was closed. And for that reason, probably there has been some improvement. Because the court system was forced to make sure that people had access to the court system, even though that was not going to be physical court access. But a couple of issues arise. One is a fair number of people are just, according to their reactions in this these listening sessions anyway, are just kind of confused or overwhelmed by the layout of the court system, and in some cases they felt simply that they needed better signage, better explanatory materials. I don't know if this is true or not more than other places, but one of these listening sessions, they thought the Anoka County Courthouse was particularly difficult to navigate. You need to know where to go, where are you supposed to report for this or that. And once again, you know, this ties in closely with people whose first language is not English. We have done a very good job, I think, of providing interpreters for formal court situations, but when you are coming into the courthouse and you don't speak English very well and you have to figure out what to do about this traffic ticket that you got, like I say, my example, I had to go show them a photograph of my license plates with the new tab stuck on them. Where do I bring that? What exactly do I have to bring with me? In that case, I think I had to, I don't think I had to make two trips because I think I looked it up first, but if you have to navigate that system without knowing the language, that can be difficult. So it's an area where, like I say, with interpreters, we've done a pretty good job in the formal courtroom, but when you have something to ask at the window, does it work quite as well? Another issue of courtroom access is public transportation. Now, I think almost every attorney who's done one or more DWI cases has heard an anecdote similar to this one. DWI defendant is there for their hearing, and then sometimes the judge will say to the defendant, "So how did you get to court today?" And the defendant is kind of standing there like a deer in the headlights because he wasn't anticipating that question because he drove to the courthouse knowing full well that he did not have a valid driver's license. Maybe he had a driver's license that was valid for going to work, but know that their driver's license is not valid for driving to your court appearances. So they kind of stand there like the deer in the headlights for a couple minutes, and then ultimately they stammer out something like, a friend drove me. And then the judge will often point to the bailiff and say, "Okay, well, good. The bailiff over here will make sure, he'll walk out to the parking lot with you and make sure that your friend picks you up. No problem." So in other words, it is an issue how to get to some of these courthouses. I had one case like that where my client was there for DWI, and he didn't have any driver's license. He wasn't supposed to be driving, and then at one break in the proceedings, he announced to me, "Oh, I have to go outside and move the car," because he was parked in a zone that was only allowed to be parked for a certain amount of time. Well, I run a full service law office, so what I told him is, "Well, give me the keys. I'll go out and move your car for you." And then he swore up and down to me that this friend was going to come and pick him up. And there's only so much I can do. But I mean, it's an issue because, and especially in areas, in suburban areas like Anoka. If you have a court appearance in Anoka County, or if you have an appearance in Washington County, the courthouse in Stillwater, or Dakota County, you have to go down to Hastings. How do you get there? Because there's really no good public transportation. So now the if you're a DWI defendant, I guess that's part of the punitive aspect of it. We have to make sure that we make it difficult for you. But on the other hand, if you're somebody needing to legitimately do business at the courthouse, that kind of does become an issue because it's how do you get there? Now in Hennepin and Ramsey County, and probably other urban counties around the country, you don't really think of it that much, because if you need to go to the if you have a court appearance downtown at Hennepin County Government Center or at the Ramsey County Courthouse, you can take the bus there. You can take the light rail. It's pretty easy to get downtown. But it's more problematic when you're in the suburbs. So now, should we coddle criminals and make sure we get them free transportation? Well, no, of course not. If you're going to do a crime in one of these counties, you should be able to figure out how to get to the courthouse yourself. But on the other hand, the system runs more efficiently when people show up when they're supposed to show up. So if you are an urban planner and you are deciding where to put the new courthouse, you might not have a lot of good alternatives, and you have to it's a big imposing structure, and you have to put it somewhere. Well, you put it in the cornfield on the outskirts of town, but on the other hand, that should be one of the considerations that when you're building this this public structure, how are we going to make sure that the public is actually able to get there? So I think that is an issue that should be considered. And also, I think now you're asking, well, what does that have to do with bias? How does that how does that relate to bias? Well, I think it probably does relate to it. And some of these things don't necessarily, some of these things are just, a lot of these listening sessions were just treated as kind of a suggestion box, maybe not necessarily relating to bias or diversity or inclusion, but just good ideas. But here, I think maybe it actually does have a little bit to do with bias, because if you live in Hennepin or Ramsey County, in Minneapolis or St. Paul, if you live in one of the core cities, you're more likely to be African American or some minority rather than a resident of Hastings or a resident of Anoka or a resident of Stillwater. This issue actually impacts you a little bit more because you go out for a night of drunk driving around the Twin Cities, okay? So you leave your home and you start, driving around, 494 and 694, you decide to do some drunk driving. Well, your path is going to take you through Anoka County and Dakota County and these suburban counties. Well, then it suddenly becomes an issue for you or maybe you even take the bus to Columbia Heights and you get in trouble. Suddenly now the center of your legal universe is the county courthouse in Anoka or in Stillwater or in Hastings, which are all pretty significant drives from your home. Whereas if you had gotten in trouble near home, then it's not that big of a deal. It's really more of an issue for residents of the core cities Minneapolis, St. Paul, probably Des Moines. It's more of an issue if you are live in one of those areas, because suddenly you have to figure out how to get out to this suburban courthouse in, like I say, Hastings or Stillwater or Ankeny. I don't know if that's the county seat down there, but you have to you suddenly have to go to some location far from your home. The Stillwater resident who gets in trouble, and or the Hastings resident who gets in trouble, who already lives near the courthouse, that's not so much of an issue for them. Or if the Stillwater resident gets in trouble in Hennepin County or Ramsey County, there probably is good transit service, and they actually can get from their suburban location to the courthouse in the downtown area. But doing it the other way around, moving from the central city to the suburban area, probably no good way to get there by bus. So, in other words, that's a factor that the courts should consider, or more so the planners of the court system. Kind of relating to that, some people talk about affordability of the courts and turning into a revolving door. And here, it's an issue to consider. I don't know what we as individual attorneys could do about this, but there's a big perception out there that the court system has kind of turned into this revolving door system. So you get yourself into some trouble, and as a result of that, you're required to pay a fine, or you're required to pay bail, or you're required to pay your attorney. Well, you don't have money to do those things. So therefore, you can't pay the fine. Well, that ultimately turns into a warrant, and as a result of the warrant, you get arrested, and you're in jail. And as a result of being in jail, well, you can't go to work, so you don't have any money, and you can't pay your fine. So it becomes kind of a vicious cycle. So there are some suggestions. Including one of these listening sessions, somebody suggested, and there might be a certain amount of merit for this, of turn yourself into. You kind of have an opportunity to wipe the slate clean and break that cycle. Probably not a bad idea to offer that sort of opportunity, at least periodically. We're getting low on time here, so I'm going to have to speed up a little bit, I guess. But you can look at these in the materials here, some specific suggestions relating to family, judicial, and mental health concerns. Disparate impact of bail. Is bail practices, are they done uniformly? And here, I think the answer to that is that in Minnesota, anyway, the judges are pretty much bound. Unfortunately, judges in this state do not have a lot of discretion when it comes to a lot of things. So judges get blamed for a lot of stuff, but oftentimes their hands are tied. Why did you let this guy out on bail, or why did you sentence this guy to such a short sentence? It could very well be because the bail guidelines or the sentencing guidelines called for that. Again, judges do not have a lot of discretion. But to the extent that they do, when a judge is setting bail, there's really only supposed to be one consideration, and that is, will the defendant appear at trial? And if the defendant will appear at trial, that's exactly the amount that we should set the bail at, not any higher or any lower. Here I'm going to give another code number, and that is B149. B149 is our next code number. B149. Well, the when the judge does that, you have to kind of use your common sense and look at this defendant and say, how likely is this person to appear for trial? And Well, if I were making that decision, I would look at the person and I would judge that person along things like, what kind of family does he have? What kind of job does he have? Because I'm pretty good at judging people, and I can make those kinds of judgments, as long as the person I'm judging is kind of has a similar background to me. But if the family connections that I should be looking for are different in that particular person's culture, well, then I haven't really made a proper decision. So I guess to the extent that our judges still have some discretion and they are making these kinds of bail decisions and sentencing decisions, to avoid having that disparate impact, they have to have some familiarity with that culture to know about it. The next two topics here, it says community and or school liaison officers. What does that have to do with elimination of bias in the legal profession? Well, this particular listening session was held at a public school in Rochester. So they were they were all sitting around the school cafeteria, and a lot of the participants were kind of thinking in terms of school. But the point they were getting at was that it would be a good idea in this case, and this was 10 years ago, There were a lot of Somali students in Rochester at that time. But at that time, there were not any Somali police officers. And in a lot of cases like this, you'll see that when there's some new immigrant group that comes to the area, there will be a certain time when they are the new people. And then after a certain amount of time goes by, they have worked their way in their system. So now this is not really relevant anymore because there are plenty of Somali police officers. There are plenty of Hmong police officers. But right now, as I say this, 2022, we're going to see more and more Afghan refugees come to this state. And I doubt if there are too many Afghan police officers. But what these parents in Rochester were talking about is kind of a long-standing problem, and that is you don't necessarily know the system very well because you are new to this country. Everything is new to you. You don't know how the legal system works. You don't know how the education system works. You don't know how anything works. Your kids, fortunately, they do understand. Because the kids, when you put them through 13 years of public school, like it or not, they're going to become American. They're going to learn how the system works here. So you get a situation where the parents know less about how the system works than their kids. And, of course, kids being kids think they know everything perfectly. So it's kind of a recipe for bad parenting where the kids know how the system works, but the parents don't know how the system works. And these parents, to their credit, recognized that and said, we need some way to interact. And here we are sitting in a school, so maybe the solution to it is to have the school liaison officer in this school be somebody from our culture, somebody who's Somali, somebody who can serve as a bridge between those two worlds. If you want to be a good parent, you have to understand the system as well as and hopefully better than your kids. And of course, the extreme example of that is when the kids are called upon to be interpreters for their parents. That's kind of a recipe for disaster. So how do we solve that? Well, perhaps we could have school liaison officers, but maybe the way to solve it, maybe the one thing that we as attorneys, as individual attorneys, do to be part of the problem is this next category in the materials here. It says education and community outreach. If you look through some of the suggestions here, and this comes up all over the state of people sitting in the same room as judges and court staff. They almost universally say, we want to learn more about how this system works. And there are a lot of suggestions here, one of them points out much of the knowledge comes from places like NCIS and Judge Judy that create misconceptions about the court system. So we want good information. One suggestion of on your cable TV channel, you have that channel where you think nobody watches it, that community access channel, sometimes with foreign language programming. Well, people do watch that, having the Ask the Lawyer program on there, that is can be a big help. Newspapers of all types are kind of becoming a thing of the past, so I don't even know if we have any foreign language newspapers. That's all gone to the internet, I think. But those media that serve other communities, and there are a lot of radio stations in foreign languages, those people are kind of clamoring to say, we want programs on some of these media sources where we can learn more about the system. So if you go down to your local cable TV public access channel, knock on the door and say, I want to do a program about talk to the lawyer. If you did that, I think you'd get a welcome audience, and if that could be done for somebody for a culture or in a language that does not have that representation, I think that is an area where we as individuals can have a great impact as individual attorneys. But on the other hand, we're not all going to do that. We're not all going to have our go down and do a radio show or a cable TV show or something. But on the other hand, I think the area where we can have the impact is just in our interactions with our larger community. You run into a lot of people in not so much in the practice of law, but just going about your business. Going to the gas station, going to the supermarket, those kinds of things, just being out there in the community. And there are, you encounter a lot of people from different cultures, different backgrounds, some of whom do not have some lawyer that they can turn to. Now, most people, it turns out, have a lawyer that they can turn to. So you have the people on your block, the people who live near you, and your relatives and everybody. Occasionally, people come to you for free legal advice, right? And you do your best, even though it's something out of your area of expertise. When people come to you for free legal advice, at least you kind of try to do your best to steer them in the right direction. So when your neighbors need a lawyer, they'll probably talk to you first because they know that you're a lawyer. And even though it's an area where you don't practice whatsoever, you'll give them some kind of basic guidance. So they get this paper from the insurance company, and you look at it and say, "Well, it's no big deal. They, don't worry about that. That's not nothing you have to worry about. That's just a notice they send out to everybody." Or you might tell them, "Well, yeah, maybe you do need to do something about this. I know this guy who practices in that area of law," or at least you give them the phone number for the Bar Association lawyer referral line or whatever. And it turns out that we as attorneys do a lot of this kind of informal gatekeeping and making sure that our friends and neighbors have access to the legal system when they need it. And it turns out almost everybody knows a lawyer. So, for most people, for your friends, it's you. Just kind of like for medical advice. You have a doctor friend somewhere, and when you have some perplexing medical issue that comes up, well, you'll run it past your doctor friend, just informally, or you have a cop friend. So when you have some question about how the police department works, well, you'll run it past your cop friend. And all these people, you probably have a plumber friend or whatever. Turnabout is fair play, so when they have questions, they come to you with their legal issues. It's a good system. But and in many immigrant communities, that also exists. So, for example, the Hmong have been in this country for, going on close to 40 years now. So those many of those kids have grown up, and they are now doctors and lawyers and police officers, and they serve that function in their community. Was not true 10 years ago, but now in the Somali community, there are Somali kids who grew up to be doctors and lawyers and cops and everything else, and they serve as that gatekeeping function for their community. So even the elders in those communities know that they can talk to some friend of their grandchildren who went to law school when they have legal questions, and they'll probably get steered in the right direction. But for these newly arrived groups of immigrants, well, that's not always the case. They might not have that person. So the one thing that we can do, I think, and like I say, everybody throughout the state is clamoring for more education and community outreach, is just to be aware of those opportunities. So when you fill up your gas tank at the gas station, the guy there is a recent immigrant, well, does he know that you're a lawyer? So just that informal outreach, this person-to-person contact, just simple human friendship, and making sure that they're aware of your status. Well, when those issues arise, when they have the need for this kind of informal interaction, that opportunity will be there for them. So just a certain amount of being a good neighbor is really one thing that we as individual attorneys can do to make the system better. Because again, look at all these comments here. People are just clamoring for that education and community outreach. Some of us can do it formally by, giving a talk at some community education event, or going on the foreign language radio station or public access cable TV program. But almost all of us can do it informally. In our remaining couple of minutes here, we're almost down to the wire and have our 2 hours out of the way. Immigration and collateral consequences. That's talked about a lot. That's going to be a bigger issue. And here it's more of a question of are judges aware of what these collateral issues are? The immigration system, wherever you stand on immigration, well, the system is the one thing everybody agrees on is things are kind of a mess, and it's not the immigration system does not necessarily work very logically. There might be immigration consequences where there really should be none. And perhaps there are no immigration consequences where there ought to be immigration consequences. Racial profiling is a topic that we're not able to, obviously in our remaining 1 minute, we're not able to talk about too much. But look through some of the many, many comments that came up about racial profiling. My last year's program, which is still on the internet, go into that in a lot more detail, and perhaps in a future program. So feel free to listen to that old program, even though the CLE credit might have expired on it. Well, with that, I see that we are up to the wire. So we're maybe I'll do a third hour the next time I do this. Before we go, though, I'll give you one more code number. That's B225. B225. All of these start with B as in bias. B225 is our final code number of the six for this program. So anyway, thank you for joining us on our quest to eliminate bias. Again, I don't think we're going to eliminate anybody's bias, but I hope at least tonight we were able to recognize some of our biases. Because, again, you want to be a fair person. I want to be a fair person. When we recognize the biases that we have, that's going to go a long way to actually eliminating them. Again, email those code numbers to me at clem.law@usa.net. If you have any other questions, you can send it to there. If you do have substantive questions or comments about the program, I welcome those very much. First of all, because I'm required to, and if you have any questions, send them to me, and I'll respond in the time allowed by your state. But other than just being required, again, I've learned more about this topic from my interaction with other attorneys, and it's kind of harder with this on-demand program. So I really do look forward to hearing any of your comments. So feel free to email those to me or give me a call. My number is 612-378-7751. But get those comments to me. Thank you for attending. If you're still need more CLE credits, check out my website, richardclem.com, where you'll find a selection of CLE programs. And I usually have links to other free programs by other providers as well. So be sure to check out the website. So thank you, and I look forward to seeing you at some of my future programs.